Welcome, viewers and listeners, to another edition of CHP Talks. I'm here today with Darshan Maharaja. And Darshan, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Rod.
It's really a pleasure to have you with us. And for the folks who may not know who you are, a little bit of background here. Darshan Maharaja, growing up in India, he witnessed the transitioning of that country's economy from an avowedly socialist one, with the government owning outright certain sectors of the economy and excessively regulating what private enterprise existed, to a significantly much freer market economy. On the political front, Darshan saw the evolution of Indian politics from the overwhelming dominance of one party to a splintering among many regional and ideological parties. Darshan is of the opinion his experiences on these two fronts are very relevant to the Canadian landscape of the 21st century, and I share that opinion, Darshan. After becoming a chartered accountant, Darshan worked in India, Africa, and the Middle East, with some exposure to Central Asia as well, before moving to Canada. The years of living in many different societies and cultures were of invaluable educational value, helped Darshan understand the nuances of divergence between diverse cultures. These two aspects are of immediate and increasingly urgent importance in today's Canada. Again, I totally agree with that sentiment. Darshan is not a member of any political party or any other social or ideological organization. So, Darshan, again, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. I know that our viewers and listeners are going to appreciate your insights. And today, especially, we're going to be focusing on MAID, medical assistance in dying, or as some call more bluntly, assisted suicide. So,
which it is, yes.
I became aware of you, Darshan, through our social media assistant, Anna Maris, who has repeatedly brought some of your great articles to my attention. They're wonderfully written, very articulate, very thoughtful. And
thank you so much.
People can visit your site, Darshan Maharaja, and get your insights. Is that the best way to you want to give the web address for that?
Yeah, it's darshanmaharaja.ca.
Darshan,
I also have a podcast which is available on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, and on Podbean. It's called Our Canadian Journey. And on Twitter, of course, I'm Theophanes Rex. That's Theophanes Rex.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I've got phones going off here. Sorry about that. Usually,
no problem.
It's off, but didn't do that today. So, anyway, Darshan, particularly, you've written a number of articles on medical assistance in dying. One of your most recent ones had to do with coercion. And so I don't know if we work our way back or we should start at the beginning, but of course, most folks listening to this program will know that the Canadian government has a program of what they call medical assistance in dying, which means basically a doctor gives you a shot that ends your life, what we would call prematurely. So if you don't mind starting at the tail end of this with coercion, what would we mean by coercion when it comes to, you know, what they are calling bodily autonomy? They try to cloak it in terms that you have the freedom to decide to kill yourself with a doctor's assistance and a government expense. Where does coercion come into the picture here? What do you think would motivate a society to begin making coercive actions to encourage people to kill themselves ahead of their time?
Rod, one problem is that when it comes to issues like assisted dying or several other issues, including the COVID vaccine, a lot of Canadians are taking a very narrow view of the definition of the term coercion. Specifically for COVID vaccine, I've been told numerous times, too numerous to count, that as long as someone was not physically held down and forcibly given the injection, it wasn't coercion. That is, of course, wrong. Coercion can be applied in so many ways, including very subtle ways. So in the context of MAID, the way I am seeing it is all these opinion polls coming out showing that one third of Canadians are okay with giving MAID to homeless people, for example. That happened a few months ago. And now that about 70% are okay with advance consent for people who have not yet been diagnosed with an irremediable terminal situation. Now, either these numbers, the poll numbers, are organic, that people are giving their actual opinion, or that they are synthetic, if one wants to be conspiracy-minded about these things. But the problem with conspiracy theories of late is that too many of them have been coming true. So I'll just keep them on the periphery of my vision. But regardless whether this is organic or synthetic, it is definitely gravely concerning that something that is literally a matter of life and death is being presented only by random opinion polls of 1,000 or 1,500 or whatever number of people. I think we have, right from the word go, we have lost track of what kind of an issue this is, and therefore what kind of an approach we need to take as a society to arrive at a conclusion. We went purely legalistic route, where the Supreme Court said that this, you know, denying someone the request to end their lives is a violation of the charter right under Section 7. So that is a legalistic approach, and I'm not minimizing that. What I'm saying is that the legal position cannot be the only consideration, especially when it comes to a matter of life and death. Because with all the advances in civilization, we haven't truly understood what makes something or someone alive. I'll give you a short example, personal example. A few years ago, I was just sitting here at my home and watching outside over to my backyard, and a bird came flying, flew halfway across my deck, and then dropped vertically to the deck. So I thought maybe something was wrong. Let me go out. As I opened the door, I expected the bird to fly away. It didn't. And I went there and I found that it had died. So the split second before, when it was in full flight, it was basically, in terms of physics, chemistry, biochemistry, whichever way you want to look at it, the same entity. But a split second later, it wasn't alive. So what was it that changed? We don't know. Right? We have not yet settled on the question of when something that is living comes into existence. More popularly known as, when does life begin?
Yes.
We, for the longest time, everybody was in agreement. Now, a lot of doubts have come in over the past few decades. And both sides are entrenched in them. Whether life begins at conception or at birth. And there is no closing the gap between the two. So with all these unresolved questions, inquiries, and disputes, taking a purely legalistic approach on assisted dying was suboptimal. As I said, legal argument has a role to play in this, but it's not the only argument. There are other arguments. Problem is, and this is probably more accentuated in Canada or in the Western world than it is elsewhere, but it has become fashionable to view religion with derision. People are derisive of any argument that comes from a religious position. Whereas the fact is that understanding the world around us, understanding ourselves, including what is inside us, has been an ongoing process ever since the dawn of time.
Yeah.
And whatever was discovered or agreed upon was codified at some point, which then got the name of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all of that is of lasting value. I'm not particularly religious, although nominally I am a Hindu. I am open to re-examining the most fundamental of the beliefs and teachings of religion, and if they still make sense to me, that's fine. I'm not going to reject something just because it is old. I'm not going to accept something just because it is new.
Right.
And I'm not going to adhere to something just because it has existed for a long time. It has to make sense to me afresh. So within that mind frame, I am quite disappointed with the way this fundamentally important issue has been handled. There hasn't been much of a public consultation on this. Back in 2015, I remember, you know, there's a church near my place and it had a sign facing the street saying death is not healthcare. But I think they have also given up since then. All the religions, I'm not necessarily focusing on Christianity here, but they have given up the fight or given in that this is going to happen and it's going to keep expanding. So that is another disappointment that I have with this. But I'm seeing this reach a level of social contagion now, where, and this is also deeply rooted in human nature, where something is harmful, but it gains wider and wider acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the wave of anorexia that swept through in the 1990s, I think it was. Before then, nobody knew what it was. Mm-hmm. Then it became a household term. Now, nobody remembers again. So it swept through. In the meantime, it caused harm.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I don't know how long this will, because it's difficult to predict, especially the future. So I don't know how long it will take for us to reverse course. But in the meantime, it's going to create enormous harm.
Yeah. And it occurred to me while you were speaking about, you know, the Supreme Court made the decision that basically, you know, promoted the concept of legalizing assisted suicide, doctor assisted death. And you might almost say that they coerced the government to enact their, you know, personal feelings as Supreme Court justices, because I know that Stephen Harper, you know, indicated whatever his real thoughts and feelings were about it, indicated that they had not much choice, that they had to go ahead. Of course, he could have used the notwithstanding clause had he really thought that was important. But then Justin Trudeau, who came in that year and then passed into law medical assisted dying in 2016, certainly could point back to the Supreme Court, said we really had no choice, that was a judicial decision. And that kind of takes the, you know, takes the blame off the shoulders. But I think they also, both Harper and Justin Trudeau, recognize that social feelings about medical assistance in dying had moved to a place where it was not unpopular to talk about it. In fact, of course, since it has been accepted, since it's been passed into law, you know, it has gone on a roller coaster ride here, and now some things that were unthinkable, you know, 10 years ago are now the things at the front of the discussion, such as, you know, the doctor killing of mentally ill patients, and the public acceptance of the idea that someone might, whereas, you know, not very many years ago, fighting suicide was on everybody's lips. How are we going to prevent this scourge of suicide from taking lives prematurely? And now it seems like many people have accepted the idea that if life is difficult, you could just choose to leave this planet, and you don't have to wait for that day when you would die of natural causes. So I saw this when the original bill was being debated at the Senate. I happened to sit in on Senate hearings, and there was a strong promotion from, I believe it was the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, and it seemed like there were bean counters there who were weighing the costs of keeping people alive as opposed to the cost of putting them down. And I was kind of shocked because I thought College of Physicians and Surgeons should be directed towards you know, medical treatment to improve life, to improve health, and to maintain life. And then I saw this sort of about face taking place where, well, it would save a lot of money. People seem to be more willing to talk about that aspect of it without shame now. Talk about, well, you know, it costs a lot of money to look after people in their elder years, and so what's wrong with giving them an easy way out and saving the taxpayer dollars? So that to me is shocking. I'm sure you feel the same way about that. Any comments about the cost element of it?
Yeah, in fact, that was the very first article that I wrote on MAID. And it's curious because this cost argument had been given barely 6 months after the original law was made in June 2016. By January 2017, CBC carried an article citing some study that was done by someone at the University of Calgary, showing that it could save, assisted dying regime could save between $35 million to $136 million a year in the healthcare system. Now, this was in January 2017, but for some odd reason, it started circulating, almost went viral in September of 2022. Wow. And that is how I got notice of it on Twitter. And then I read it, and then that was my first article, where, to me at least, it is highly offensive to consider the money argument in deciding whether someone should live or die, or even for medical treatment. Unfortunately, because we have the kind of structure of healthcare system that we do here, which is a single payer system, this was inevitable. And while this is, of course, shocking for someone to say that, you know, helping people to die will help us save money, I had seen an earlier example of this. This was probably back in 2018 or thereabouts, when an indigenous girl, I think from Alberta or Saskatchewan, her dental treatment was going to cost $6,000. And the government was fighting that in court and had, by that time, spent $110,000 on legal fees. And the case was still ongoing. So there are a couple of things here. And because I grew up in a socialist country, I have closer experience with that and hopefully better understanding of it, which is that within all these budgetary allocations, the bean counters will always rule the roost. But the alternative that leads to higher cost will be in nobody's view, on nobody's radar, which is why it's possible to spend $110,000 fighting a claim of $6,000. To an average person, and certainly in the private sector, they would have settled it at some amicable amount instead of. But here, there is a sort of a lobby or, you know, vested interest or whatever you want to call it, which finds a reason to leech off more public money for its own benefit. And as long as that $6,000 claim is outstanding, they get to leech off more and more. Similarly, in this assisted dying issue, now, and I wrote about this in one of my articles, that you now have sectors of industry that benefit from this regime. So for them, it is additional revenue. And as long as they have a hold, possibly stranglehold, on the way the policy goes, you're not going to have any success in holding back the expansion of assisted dying, let alone reversal. You spoke about coercion. See, the court gave Parliament 1 year to come up with a law. But as a private individual, I am seeing where is the or else. Suppose Parliament did not make that law, what would have been the consequence for the Parliament or parliamentarians or the government or whoever?
Mm-hmm.
There was no or else. And to remind you, in the famous Morgenthaler verdict, the Supreme Court also asked the Parliament to formulate a law which hasn't happened till now. That's 35 years.
Yeah.
Because there is no or else.
Right.
They can choose to ignore it, but they didn't. And that is because of the Overton window. Overton window, not of public opinion necessarily, but Overton window of the possibility of benefiting from a particular course of action, benefiting politically. Which is why the Parliament was in a hurry to meet the deadline. And, you know, they all make all these pious statements with somber faces saying, hey, the court has given us a deadline and we have to keep it. We know how seriously you take the court.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give us that cock and bull story. So that is how the other Overton window was opened. That what was previously unthinkable was now official policy. That people who are death could only be natural. I mean, that's a separate issue, but barring accident or, you know, things like that, in today's world, death for humans is always natural. Now, you expanded that to people whose natural death is not reasonably foreseeable. And in the horrific style that is characteristic of officialdom, they call it track to me, as if it represents an improvement. Mm-hmm. But there are serious arguments to be made from either side. So don't tell us as a fact that it is an improvement. Let's settle that argument first. So, I mean, this is a contagion, as I said. Depends on how far the wildfire goes until it burns itself out.
Well, the summer, the survey that you sent me yesterday Ipsos survey, of course, as we discussed earlier, the questions even that they asked were quite biased and probably designed to lead people to say what the Ipsos surveyors wanted to have said, for whatever reason. But their first statement highlighted says, support for made and advance requests among Canadians remains strong, with only minor decreases despite increased news coverage and debate. So they're sounding like there's a lot of debate going on, but still Canadians agree with this. So there's some shocking numbers there. I don't totally trust these numbers, but they're not completely made up. I'm sure that they're not just fabrications, even though they led people to say the things. They say 71% of those they surveyed support the ability for mature minors to request and be eligible for MAID. They say 80% support access to MAID for those suffering solely from a mental illness. Now, that is shocking. That means if they're correct, if those are real numbers, 8 out of 10 Canadians think that people with mental illness should be put on a sort of a fast track to having their lives taken rather than having serious and sincere efforts made to mitigate their mental illness. And then they talk about, of course, and this gives a hint to the bias of the survey people, but they say they consider MAID as part of the full range of healthcare services. So, you know, of course, how helping someone to die is a healthcare service, I will never understand that way of looking at life, but there are people who look at it that way. You mentioned the Overton window. I think most of our listeners will be aware of the concept of the Overton window. Between two extreme positions, there is a range that is considered acceptable to maybe a majority of the population. And of course, this whole discussion began with someone at the far end of physical suffering, I suppose. And now the other end of what they are claiming is within the Overton window is now a teenager who is having a bad day, almost, to go to the other extreme. And people who, you know, going through a period of time when their mental health is being impacted, that if they wanted to end their life, a doctor would help them do it. That's kind of the extremes there. But the what's significant is that public opinion has been dragged through the Overton window, or has been engaged in such a way by the legalization and promotion of the topic of doctor-assisted suicide to accept things that we would not have accepted 10 years ago.
Yeah, see, again, taking a purely legalistic view is problematic for this reason. If accessing assisted suicide is a charter right, then you cannot prevent someone from putting up a billboard offering that service. Because yeah, it is attached to someone exercising their charter right. And denying the permission to put up that billboard can be interpreted legalistically as reducing access to a charter right.
Wow.
So, see, then this is one point that I have made repeatedly in my articles, which is that from time immemorial, it has been a subject of debate when it comes to ending a human life by human intervention. And people have tried often failed, sometimes succeeded in devising some kind of a structure of rules and regulations where this could be decided. I'm not saying allowed, but at least decided whether it should be allowed or not. And there are times when they went astray and, you know, stoning to death of a woman on charges of adultery, for example. Thankfully, we don't have that anymore, but there are parts of the world where that is still practiced. So you come down to the issue of ending a human life by human intervention. And there is this inner awareness, or at least an inkling in everyone, that there are certain things in this creation that are beyond the comprehension of humans. Now, that comprehension advances as time passes. So what were matters of religion at one point are now matters of science. But this issue of, you know, life itself, what makes something living, that is something that we have not yet cracked. And as long as that remains the case, we have to approach the issue of ending human lives by human intervention with extreme caution. It cannot be decided by Supreme Court verdicts or opinion polls, although those are necessary ingredients of the final solution. But it cannot be decided by opinion polls. For example, if you recollect, there is a famous episode of Yes Minister, that BBC series, a classic, where Sir Humphrey Appleby shows to his junior Bernard how the same person can be led through a series of questions to finally give the exact opposite answer to the previous one.
Wow.
Are you in favor of this or not? And then Sir Humphrey asks four or five questions and it neatly guides Bernard to say yes. Then he says, okay, now let's go through another set of questions. And then that set of questions leads Bernard neatly to say no. So it's you know, also a science, and like all sciences, it can be misused. And so first of all, there would be that element of caution when looking at any opinion poll. But I think what is happening here is that there is, first of all, the judicial come legislative input, because judiciary is always in a hurry to catch up to, I mean, the legislative body is always in a hurry to catch up to the judicial reinterpretation of the right to die. And the judicial reinterpretation is driven by activism, which is behind the scenes, although the entities are out in the open. What they actually do, people like Dying with Dignity Canada or CAMAP, the Canadian Association of Maids, Assessors and Providers. And these are both charities, by the way. So their activism is largely behind the scenes, although Alexander Rakin did an excellent investigative piece on how they train and what kind of scenarios they envisage and all that. Wonderful piece. So what is happening is that you have this behind-the-scenes activism pushing the judicial reinterpretation of the right to die, and then the legislative body in a hurry to catch up to that reinterpretation. And in the meantime, all these opinion polls have started very recently. Although the issue blew up in the public sphere almost 9 or 10 months ago, because I wrote my article around that time, the first one. So I remember that was a hot issue. So I think this is also partly a reaction or attempt at damage control, because individuals like me and Alex Rakin, etc. Rupa Subramania wrote a great piece on that. So we were influencing public opinion, so that had to be countered. It's very simple. And I have nothing against that. This is how human societies function. But you cannot let that be the, or those to be the only components of the decision making. And here I put a lot of the blame on the opposition parties, especially the Conservative Party. NDP and Greens are largely on board with this ongoing expansion. But Conservative Party should organize on its own public events where people can benefit from each other's ideas. They can explore jointly so that you have a ground swell. This is not going to be dealt with in the parliament. I have read the proceedings of the committee meeting, and doctor after doctor kept saying that we cannot ascertain with absolute guarantee whether a mental illness is irremediable or not. But even then, the expansion is going to go ahead. They just bought 1 year, and Minister Lametti said very clearly on CBC's program. He said, we are just buying time.
Yeah.
And the profession wants to make sure that they have proper training in place. But that's like putting up a superstructure where the foundation does not exist. Mm-hmm. Because your fundamental question is whether the illness is irremediable or not.
Yeah.
If that cannot be determined with any degree of certainty, then the rest of all the training and all, that is of no use.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the fundamental questions are being sidestepped in order to advance this policy. That's my view.
Yeah. In British Columbia, we have the Delta Hospice Society. President is Angelina Ireland. And a couple of years ago, the BC government, the NDP government here, tried to coerce them. These governments seem to like coercion of one form or another, to expand their services, so-called, into killing their patients. They have had a beautiful palliative care facility, unlike anything else in Canada, where people could go to live out their last days and have wonderful care. But the government was not content with, and as you probably know, palliative care is very rare. Not all Canadians have access to palliative care. It's one of the things that should be improved in our society, and it's a costly thing, but it should be made available. Anyway, the government of BC was unwilling to have this one facility, 13 beds, dedicated to comfort care and real health care in the final days. They wanted them to participate in the killing, medical assistance in dying. And when they refused, the government basically stole their facility that had been built with the donations of concerned members of society, some $8 million worth of a facility. The problem was, it was they owned the facility, but it was on leased from the government. The land was leased from the government, so the government pulled the lease and took it away. But that is the level of where the government puts pressure on people. They're not willing to have anyone stand against the tide. We saw that with the coercion towards COVID vaccinations and so on. The government is not willing to have anyone take a different path. They want everybody to endorse and joyfully participate in whatever path the government has chosen. And it's really sad that because then it means they close their ears and eyes to information that they should be receiving, especially about the dignity of mankind and the meaning of life and those types of things. They're all put on the back burner because everything is about full participation in this destructive practice.
Yeah, and you know, this increasing totalitarianism or authoritarianism is especially disappointing for someone like me, who grew up in such a society or such a governmental structure and had an opinion of countries like Canada and the USA and Western Europe, where we yearned to be in that kind of a free society where the individual was basically supreme with reasonable restrictions. And the state did not force us to do anything. That was the rose-tinted view that we had when I was growing up through my young youth and, you know, all the way until I came to Canada. And even then, I mean, there were aspects of it that I thought were authoritarian. And maybe it's because I didn't know, I wasn't fully familiar with a lot of things as I am now. But this is a complete letdown for a first-generation immigrant like me, who grew up in a similar restrictive, authoritarian government structure. And I don't know whether this is increasing or not. Maybe you are better placed to make that assessment, you know, with longer time in Canada. But in the current time, in real time, it is increasing. And I mentioned in one of my articles that over maybe at some point in the past 50-odd years, Canada went from being a ruggedly individualistic society to trenchantly collectivist. So what happens is that when things like this get promoted, whether it was coercion for COVID or expansion of MAID or you name it, carbon tax, you know, there are so many things where offering a dissenting opinion makes you a villain. Someone can disagree all they like, but here they are disrespecting my right to have a different opinion. That is where, just as you have internalized racism or internalized misogyny, we have internalized totalitarianism among a lot of Canadians. And that is a far greater challenge than dealing with a totalitarian government, because government can be voted out and hopefully replaced by one that reverses the course. But when this mindset has entered the, you know, inner thoughts of so many Canadians, difficult to change that.
Well, that sobering thought, but I think that's a good place to leave this and let our listeners meditate on that. It's one thing to have a tyrant or a tyrannical government at the helm, dictating what we can and can't do. It's another thing when the people themselves have become so accustomed to that that they continually choose, even at the polls, to remain under the thumb or under the boot of such a dictatorship. So. Darshan Maharaja, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure having you on. I'm going to continue reading your great articles that you write so well. And for folks, again, who want to visit your site, it's darshanmaharaja.ca.
That is correct.
And your podcast, again, give us that address.
Our Canadian Journey.
Our Canadian Journey.
It's on Spotify, Google Podcast, and Podbean.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. God bless you. And we look forward to better days ahead. There's nothing on the horizon that tells me that it's going to be better, just that we know that if we continue to go down this slippery slope into the dark abyss, more Canadians will be making bad choices. So we want people to be able to choose life and to choose freely to drink from the water of life and remain here as citizens, not to be prematurely expelled from this planet. So thank you,
Lord, for all the gloomy tone of my writing and audio podcast. I remain an optimist because unexpected things can happen. They do happen, and they have happened in far more daunting circumstances. If one happens to be religious, one can say that God moves in mysterious ways. That's a different way of saying it, but that's basically the same thing. So we have to keep trying and remain optimistic.
Well, thank you for continually putting the effort into expressing these thoughts so well in your articles and podcasts. So thank you, and God bless you.
Thank you.
Yeah, goodbye.